Nation.
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan, and we have two issues that are important to everyone in Florida to talk about on the show today, jobs and water. Later on in the show, we'll hear from a North Central Florida activist to give us the latest information about a story we've been following for a couple of years on WMNF's Midpoint. It's an attempt by companies, including the food giant Nestle, to bottle more water from Florida springs to sell it on supermarket shelves. So stay tuned for that at the bottom of the hour. But first up, let me admit our guests here. And Lisa, if you can unmute yourself, please. Joining us live by Zoom are Lisa Perry and Kelly Johnson. Lisa Perry is with the group Common Ground Florida. 4 years ago, we had Lisa on the show to preview the Women's March in St. Petersburg. It turned out to be one of the most massive demonstrations in the city's history. And last year, our other guest, Kelly Johnson ran for the Florida legislature in a House seat in North Pinellas and Northwestern Hillsborough County. She was on the show last spring to talk about her work helping people who are struggling to get unemployment benefits and to announce her candidacy. Kelly helped organize a Facebook group called Action Group for COVID-19 Unemployment, and now she's helping with the Faces of Florida YouTube project. So welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Lisa and Kelly.
Thank you. Thanks. Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
I'm glad that you're both able to come on. Thanks for coming on the show. Before we talk about the unemployment compensation issues in Florida, let me first ask you about the scale of the unemployment program. How many Floridians have lost their jobs during the COVID-19 pandemic?
You want to take that, Kelly?
I'd take it.
I honestly, Sean, I don't have an exact number, but I can tell you that, you know, it's widespread and there are thousands of Floridians all over the place. And I know Kelly does, you know, work directly with them every single day, hours upon hours. So, you know, I know that unemployment has been an issue in Florida for a long time, but we're seeing it be more mainstream in the wake of the pandemic. And I think that that's just why we're hearing about it and why it's critical to address the issue now.
Of course, we had to go in several stages. For example, when the pandemic first hit, there were several hundreds of thousands of unemployed Floridians, but it's really hard to get that exact number. And I'll tell you why. Because the amount of people that are unemployed versus the amount of people that are technically on benefits are two very different numbers. So while the numbers might have said about 250,000 are on unemployment benefits, the actual number of unemployed was much greater than that. I know one of the things that states like to do is they like to have about, you know, half being unemployed and the other half, you know, on unemployment, where the other half might be like going back to school, might have to be mom or whatever. So they might not technically be on unemployment benefits. Before the pandemic hit, Florida was at 11% of its unemployed that were actually receiving unemployment benefits, which was far below the national average.
So maybe one way to put that, Kelly, would be that even before the pandemic, the employment situation in Florida wasn't perfect. It wasn't like everyone or most everyone had a good paying job and they could make ends meet, because a lot of this is driven by our service economy. How does that affect the employment situation in Florida?
It's been an absolute disaster because we are a huge state for hospitality, because the state relies heavily on its tourism dollars. Most of the people who have been on unemployment are in the hospitality business. On top of that, what's actually making that even more difficult is many of those employees were under 1099, whether or not they were supposed to be, which is another issue that I know that they're dealing with. Many employers have been getting out of paying their employees' taxes by 1099-ing the employees and making them go under a self-employment type of income. And so that kind of came all to the surface through the pandemic. I mean, here we were right under our noses with a disease that was happening, but I guess there just wasn't enough attention to it. There weren't enough people that were on unemployment that really felt that they could make a difference. And now instead of the 4% number, we got up to 10%, 12% unemployed. So it truly did uncover a much greater, larger problem that we've been having in the state for a long time.
Lisa, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just like to add that we, you know, and on top of the service industry folks that are on unemployment, our benefits in the state of Florida have not been increased per week since 1998. So, you know, the folks that are receiving unemployment benefits due to loss of their jobs, especially in the wake of COVID-19, they are, you know, we're receiving one of the lowest rates in the nation. And so putting money back into Floridians' pockets is very essential. As Kelly, you know, had mentioned, like, we're just a huge hospitality state. We are driven on tourism. And so not only are we missing out on supporting our service industry folks and hospitality folks in the state, but we're also unable to fuel our economy because the people who are out of work and the folks who are being hit the hardest are also not out spending money, right? So it's a two-way street where our state is not bringing in money, and we're also not able to get people the benefits they need to just put a roof over their head or food on their plate. And so I think that we have to look at the whole picture and really understand how broken the system was before the pandemic. And it only took something like this to just make it just such a widespread and just really out of control, critical issue to deal with now.
Our guests are Lisa Perry with the group Common Ground Florida and Kelly Johnson, who is helping with something called the Faces of Florida YouTube project. And we'll talk about that later on in the show. And my name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint on 88.5 FM. It's 12:12 in the afternoon. And, you know, if you have a comment that you'd like to mention, if you've had trouble getting into the Florida unemployment system, or if the pandemic has really affected you, why don't you give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. If you text us, at least tell me your name and where you're texting from, please. So Lisa, you were talking about how bad, even before the pandemic, that Florida's unemployment compensation system was, that the benefits hadn't increased in many years. Give us an idea of what kind of benefits are we talking about? If you lose your job, and let's say you had a good paying job where you could pay your mortgage or your rent beforehand, what will you possibly end up with later if you successfully navigate the Florida unemployment system?
Sure. Well, let's put this in perspective. The average rate, the lowest rate of a Florida state employee is $600 a week. When a hardworking Floridian gets unemployment, the maximum benefits that they can receive is $275 a week. So if you add that up, you know, trying to support, and that also, let me just back that up for a second, has not matched our weight of, you know, we have just passed increasing minimum wage. And so this is not, our unemployment benefits payout is not keeping up with the cost of living and hasn't been for 20 years. So, and Kelly, I'm sure that you could probably speak more to like the specifics on what you're, you know, how it just, that's the maximum, the $275 a week. So I know that it only gets worse from there.
Yeah, good point, Lisa. You know, and, you know, from my experience in the Facebook group with the many, many people that I get to talk with every day, the benefits are in itself just a disaster. Nobody is able to really sustain their income on unemployment benefits. And I understand that it's not supposed to be this great big income source, but it is supposed to be a helping hand when you are at a time of need. And it has really missed the mark on that. For example, when we had the extra federal benefit, which was $600, the claimants that were able to get benefits were doing very well. They were paying their rents. Everything was great. When the LWA went into effect, that was the executive order set by Trump, which Florida only got 3 weeks and only $300. After that expired, we had about 4 months where there were no additional benefits, and Floridians were forced to live off of the benefits that were set in place by the state. And that put so many people down the poverty line and created a really serious situation for many households across the state.
Well, we're going to talk in a second about why there was a gap, why there was this time where there was no federal money left over for the Floridians. But I just want to remind people that that was Kelly Johnson, who is helping with a Faces of Florida YouTube project. And earlier we heard Lisa Perry with the group Common Ground Florida. So, Kelly, why don't you tell us, why was it that the $600 federal supplement to unemployment insurance went away? What happened to that money? And is any of it coming back?
Well, that's a very loaded question. I'm going to try to answer this in what my experience is, and I'm sure Lisa will have more input as well. But with the $600 benefit, the government basically didn't know what we were looking at in terms of our economy. We basically were chartered in, we were in unchartered territory. So they estimated through their best guess that we would be okay in July, or at least we would be able to pass something. What happened after July was we, as you saw, we were having a resurgence of cases. And I really do feel like it was a complete failure of government, because it wasn't concerning them so much. I don't understand why, for example, the stimulus, getting off of unemployment, a stimulus is made to stimulate the economy, just like unemployment benefits. Because we have such a massive amount of people unemployed, those are actually stimulating the economy. So why they were so surprised when all of a sudden the economy tanked again because we didn't have any additional unemployment benefits just really amazes me, because that's their job over this country and over the state. And there were several states, side note, that did kick in additional benefits because they had the wherewithal to see what was going to happen in the economy. However, Florida was not one of the people, one of the states at all to even entertain that thought. So as far as like going into getting extra benefits, I do believe that there will be another plan passed. But if it's anything like how long it took for the last plan, it's going to be disaster. Right now we have 6 weeks where many claimants who were claiming without an issue are being locked out of their benefits because the original CARES Act was allowed to expire on 12/26. And none of this would be an issue if we had decent, livable type of wage benefit amounts for unemployment benefits. Floridians would have been able to weather the storm if we had had a stronger system in place with the unemployment benefits.
Lisa, do you have something to add?
Yeah, I just, I think that one of the main issues is that our unemployment system and what's happening to hardworking Americans, like across the nation, but particularly in Florida, is that it's being so politicized. We're so divided, right, in D.C. and Tallahassee and across the country. And this is really an issue that is going to, if we look at it holistically, that this is affecting everybody. And this is something that we should address together. You know, that's one thing that I think is preventing some progress is just the absolute division that we've been seeing over the past year as we've gone through this pandemic. I think that also seeing that, a lot of the responsibility had been thrust upon the states and in order to respond has also been a huge issue. And then, I can't not hold the governor accountable, because I do think that our governor, DeSantis, has had opportunities to really address this issue and to get ahead of it. And, I think that one of the things that I continue to hear is that we need to fix the website, and we need to fix the website. And yes, we do. We need to fix the website. But there's also a huge issue with getting, so many of us like back having the ability to pay out during when people are getting their benefits. I think that there's also a lot of pressure for people to continue to look for jobs. And so there's a lot of nuance to like each individual case and what's going on, with those people, and just navigating such a broken system has been so hard. And I think that if we would work together, it's not a hard fix.
Our guests are Lisa Perry with the group Common Ground Florida and Kelly Johnson, who helped organize a Facebook group called Action Group for COVID-19 Unemployment. And we're talking about Florida's unemployment situation, the difficult to navigate website, how difficult it is to get benefits, and how kind of insufficient those benefits are and have been for years. And you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday at 12:20 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan, and we're taking your calls at 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. What's been your experience, good or bad, with applying for benefits under Florida's unemployment system? Let us know. Well, so we keep going back to the website and how difficult it is, and that goes back to 2011. What do we know about how the program was set up in 2011 under then Governor Rick Scott, who set it up, and what do you think that the motivation was for making it the way it is?
Well, obviously, you just said who set it up. The transaction was authorized through Rick Scott. As far as the company, you know, it's my brother. He's amazing. He works for Fiserv. And when the stimulus was being pumped out, they were processing 4,000 transactions a second without an issue. So it's like, you know, do you build a website which will accommodate for growth of population as well as be prepared for, you know, an emergency where there may be some extra users on the system, you know, not even thinking about a pandemic. So that was the software designer's job, and they failed it. For us, as I see all the updates go through, especially with the extension, and as I've seen them deal with the computer system, it is broken, but it is a workable system. The thing that we see more in the groups than anything is the fact that the call center employees do not have enough information to help the claimants that are calling. I've had to sidestep and talk to the inspector general as well as, you know, some of the press corps over there to get claimants paid. And, it, you know, they're very willing and amazing, and they are doing the best that they can. But the system simply is not good enough for the amount of traffic that it will receive, period, in the future. So it does need to be just, in my opinion, blown up and started over again, but that's mine.
So this is still a problem. I mean, it was in the news a lot in March and April and May, but you know, I have to say, we haven't heard that much about the system lately, but you're saying that still, it's still taking, there are too many applicants for the system to handle?
It just took them 6 weeks to implement. It just got in today. One of the federal requirements of the CARES Act extension, I think it's in page 1783 or something like that. Not that I read the whole thing, but it was kind of a large document. It specifically states that we need to go through some kind of a reapplication, recertification process through the states in order to receive our extension. I had not gone through that process. I was still getting my benefits, but many people were still locked out. They just implemented the message in the system to get that certification, that verification sent over to them. So that's, and they still haven't implemented the mixed earners income, which was an extra $100 supplement. So that's how, and it's a system, I have to say this too, I'm sorry. You're only able to access the system until 8 o'clock at night. It can't take information and process payments at the same time. So it has to be shut down completely on the user end and process payments throughout the overnight.
And I think going back to when Governor Rick Scott had reformed unemployment in 2011, what we saw was the argument that small businesses needed the tax break in order to pay out their employees to support themselves. And what ended up happening is a lot of that tax break went to larger corporations, right? And so the argument was that we were protecting small businesses, but we have a lot of small businesses that that support unemployment reform that absolutely, you know, we're collecting stories and validators that are able to, you know, show as a small business that this is not necessarily true. The rate of pay to keep your employees protected in a situation like this, it just doesn't match up. And what really ended up happening was those tax cuts went to the bigger corporations. And as we collected less taxes, then that meant less benefits for Floridians. And that's something that, you know, landed in 2011 and is one of the main reasons that we have pushback in the state today in order to fix it, is that same argument.
Our guests are Lisa Perry with the group Common Ground Florida and Kelly Johnson, who helped organize a Facebook group called Action Group for COVID-19 Unemployment. And we're talking about Florida's unemployment system and how difficult it is to get benefits and how those benefits are really low compared to a lot of other states. This is WMNF's Midpoint Monday. We have about 5 minutes left in this segment. It's 12:25 in the afternoon, but we'd like you to call in if you have anything you'd like to say about the unemployment system in Florida. It's 813-239-9663. And I hope you stay tuned. After this interview, we're going to talk about Nestle trying to bottle more water from Florida Springs. So that's coming up in about 5 or 6 minutes. And let me ask you, Lisa, we've been talking about the company that set this up, but we haven't mentioned any names yet. It's Deloitte Consulting. And they actually were able, even after we knew about all the failures in the Florida unemployment system, they were able to move forward with a potential $135 million contract to overhaul the state's Medicaid data system. This is just happening in the last 12 months or 9 months. What do you know about Deloitte, and how do you think that they'll do with this Medicaid data system?
Obviously, you know, I'm pretty skeptical because I think that what we have to really look at is who benefits ultimately, and why are, you know, the same companies being chosen to like overhaul something that they failed at originally, right? And so what I think that we really need to, as advocates in the state of Florida, as community members that are affected, is that we need to pay attention. And when and actually see what these larger companies are doing. We can't just like let this happen kind of behind the curtain and not be aware of it. And so that's something that we have the power to do in Florida as you know, voters, as citizens. And I think that it's critical for us to watch this as it plays out, and to hold folks accountable, and to get involved with like the actions that, you know, Kelly is really hosting and doing right now in terms of that grassroots energy, and demanding that we are part of this too, and that it's not just left to the big corporations that have failed us in the past.
So Kelly, let me ask you that. What is Faces of Florida YouTube project, and how can people get involved?
Well, you can go on to YouTube and search, I'll tell you real quick, Faces of Florida 2021, but you can also go online. It's also going through my website, which is faces-of-florida.net. It's pretty simple, except for all the dashes. But we need to have a voice. When I had started with the unemployment group, we protested throughout the state, including Tallahassee, Orlando, Tampa, Naples, Miami. We need to, I feel like collectively we are a stronger voice. And so as a grassroots movement, just trying to get those people that have gone through unemployment, that, you know, it has been such a hardship for so many of them, to go ahead and gather together as one united voice and push for the reform. Because right now it's already been set up. They're not even going to try to address it at the next session, because they don't see it as an issue. And then, of course, they're blaming budget shortfalls as well, which we wouldn't even get into. That's another story for another day. However, so we have a lot that we're battling up against. But the bottom line is, all these people didn't go through this for nothing. I didn't go through this for nothing. It needs to be fixed. And we're doing whatever we can by sending videos to our legislators, you know, texting, calling, and just really being one united voice to help push unemployment reform through at next session.
And Lisa, Kelly has mentioned some of the things that you're doing, but what else is, tell us about Common Ground Florida and what your actions are happening on this issue, Lisa.
Sure. You know, this is an issue that we have been working on for several years before the pandemic. And what, you know, we do a lot of voter education. So typically we'd be in Tallahassee sending some folks up with lobby day, having these meetings with legislators. Obviously, it's a different landscape right now. And so what we're doing is trying to support the work of Faces of Florida, because we think the priority is that constituents have an opportunity to speak with their legislators. We are also, you know, doing some video collection on our end, and then training. So if you haven't ever had a, you know, meeting with a legislator, but it's something that you're interested in doing, we'll be hosting a training on how to do that and just how to navigate that meeting and go into it diplomatically, have a productive conversation. And so that's, you know, we're hosting a lot of trainings like that, and then also some story collection, but mainly supporting just the grassroots efforts in whatever way our organization can be helpful.
Well, Lisa and Kelly, thanks so much for coming on WMNF's Midpoint today. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Lisa Perry is with the group Common Ground Florida, and Kelly Johnson is helping to organize the Faces of Florida YouTube project. We're going to be right back after this short music break. We'll hear about the latest in the attempt by Nestle to take more water from Florida springs, put it in disposable plastic bottles, and then sell it on grocery shelves. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. The food giant Nestle is collaborating with a company called Seven Springs Water to get a permit renewal to take nearly 1 million gallons a day of water from springs connected to the Santa Fe River in north central Florida. Recently, an administrative law judge ruled in favor of the permit applicants, contradicting staff recommendations from the Suwannee River Water Management District. So to find out the latest on what this means for Florida water, this morning I spoke with Marilee Malwitz-Gipson. She's a board member with the group Our Santa Fe River. Marilee Malwitz-Gipson with Our Santa Fe River, thanks so much for coming on WMNF today. What can you tell us about your group, Our Santa Fe River?
Sean, first I'd like to just start off with thanking you so much for bringing this to your listener audience. I know you've been following, the station's been following it almost from the get-go. I also wanted, on a personal note, as a longtime listener and supporter, my husband, by the way, says hello, and he loves you all so much. So I just wanted to get that out first. My husband, Doug, loves the station. We miss it so much up here.
Thanks, Doug.
So back to the Santa Fe River that we're dealing with today, the organization. So we got our start in technically 2006. 2007, we formed, we being people that either live along the river or recreate on the Santa Fe River, created a organization called Our Santa Fe River, the pronoun our. A lot of people think it's save, but it's actually a pronoun title, reflecting that we all, anybody that joins the organization and anyone, all have a way to give this water body a voice. It's Our Santa Fe River. And so we started recognizing that there were 4 water bottling plants permits coming into the Santa Fe River, and we got very strongly organized, and we had weekly meetings in four different counties to fight off these 4 water bottling plants, even though they existed technically in 3 of these counties. The Santa Fe River encompasses 7 counties in its entire basin. So we saw that water bottlers wanted to come in where the most abundant fresh water, spring water sources were. And after 7 years of fighting hard and organizing as a 501c3 with lots of community support, so much community support, we were able to fend off all 7 of those. In 7 years, we were able to fight off all 4 of those water bottling operations. We knew at that time that we had one bottler that was already bottling since technically 1994 at Ginny Springs. The spring famous on the Santa Fe River for lots of partying and campground activities. And we knew that the owners of that campground were the ones responsible for bringing in this water bottling operation to this region of north central Florida in the Springs heartland. However, because that bottling permit existed statutorily through permitting, we knew that the laws were against us to just step in and say, hey, we're going to stop this bottled water permit, you know, down. We're going to just shut her down. That's just not possible. So what we did was we waited until a 20-year review came up. It was reissued, by the way, in 1999, and that's where the 20-year review, because in 2019, that's when the review of this 20-year-long permit took place. And the thing with water, resources in the state of Florida is that no landowner owns water, like Western water law or other water law in our country. In our state, the water is protected by the water managers. And the water managers, we have five boards set up throughout regional parts of Florida. And our particular board, the Suwannee River Water Management District, is who governs, who gives out permits for people that come in for their needs to use water, a common source of all of our water out of the aquifer, for whatever their intentions. And so in this particular case, in 1994-99, these people saw that they could profit from spring water being put into plastic bottles. And they sell, the family that owns the campground, it gets a little murky in here because they set up a company, actually they set up a partnership to start with, which turned into a company called Seven Springs Water Company. And that's the entity that actually has control of the permit at the moment going for review. And the people now who are board members or whatever, members of that particular company, this LLC that exists in the state of Florida, those are the ones that are reapplying for the permit, not the big corporation that you'll hear about later in this conversation, but the family member, or they're not even family members, but the people that are on the board are the ones that are actually applying for the permit. So we stepped in again in 2019, finding out, of course, because it became public knowledge that they were, this entity, Seven Springs Water Company, had Nestle Waters of North America in their sites to sell our public water supply, our water that courses underneath the ground, underneath us and down toward you and all over the state of Florida through the Florida Aquifer, and also technically is pushed out, forced out through the springs that are on the Santa Fe River in this particular region of Florida. This company, Seven Springs, had it in their sights to sell this water use that they were able or will that they intended to get permitted for another, actually this time it'll only be 5 years. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that, but a 5-year permit to Nestle. And Nestle, while Seven Springs doesn't pay the state of Florida one penny for that water, and the permit only costs $115, Nestle will be not only profiting greatly on the amount of bottles that they intend to produce out of this one extraction location, but also the private entity, the Seven Springs Water Company, will also profit greatly.
We're speaking with Marilee Malwitz-Gibson, who's a board member of the group Our Santa Fe River, and we're talking about the possibility of having water withdrawn, more water withdrawn from springs to be bottled and sold on supermarket shelves. And you've been setting up this interaction between Nestle and this group called Seven Springs Water Company, and that came before the board of the Suwannee River Water Management District last year. What happened when that came before their board?
So in March of last year, 2019, after we spent probably, I don't know, it was 10 months or longer, interacting with the water managers, the Suwannee River Water Management District staff, reviewing the permit process, the staff, after much concern and review and materials, decided to deny the water use permit. And at that very moment, the attorneys for Seven Springs Water Company, who happened to be the hired attorneys from Nestle, they filed for an administrative hearing. And they wanted a judge to rule on this recommended order from the staff, which was a denial. They wanted a judge to go through all the materials that it would be their side and technically the Suwannee River Water Management District's attorney's side, and see what the judge would rule on, because they recognized that there was a possibility of the board denying this permit if the staff was going to deny it. So that was in March, and because of that movement, it went into an admin hearing, and it was not heard in front of the board at that point in time. And the administrative hearing process took up until, 2 weeks ago, when the judge finally ruled on the testimony of both sides, of the water managers and of Seven Springs Water Company, and consequently their attorneys of Nestle's. And the judge favored, with no surprise to anybody, favored Nestle, favored Seven Springs Water Company. And the ruling effect of this was procedural at best. Our Santa Fe River tried to, sometime in the summer, after the two sides negotiated during this legal process, this legal administrative process, they negotiated to have a consensus where they were going to, Seven Springs was going to reduce their extraction to, instead of 1,152,000 gallons a day, they agreed at 984,000 gallons a day. They both agreed that bulk transference of water to another facility that Nestle owns up the road a ways up in Madison County at the Lee plant, at the Lee Nestle plant, was going to be allowable. And then the plant would likely be able to produce 984,000 gallons of water, because right now, presently, it can't. In the past, to give you an idea of numbers, to give your audience an idea, they only bottled at the facility located off of County Road 340 near Ginny Springs Campground. Three or four bottler companies have come and gone, and at the most, any of those bottling companies have produced was roughly under 300,000 gallons of bottled water. So here we're looking at, even though it's not a increase of the permit itself, well, now it's a reduction, but anyway, the amount of water being talked about in terms of extraction, the reality is at no point in time was that ever extracted at this location. And so Nestle has a tremendous amount of infrastructure to put in to accommodate 984,000 gallons of water, which they had to prove to the water managers that they were capable of producing. So those were the three arguments. Can you produce that much water? Can you bulk it somewhere else? And there's a reduction in water. And so those issues went back in front of the board. And the original denial from the water managers was also contractual. What does the contract look like? And that had to do with how much water could you produce, basically. And so they had never seen the contract, of course, because it's proprietary in effect. And Nestle and Seven Springs produced instead of the contract, or any part of it, or any redacted form of it, was a memorandum of agreement between the two parties that they could produce that much water. So fast forward to then it went in front of the board again, the water management board, after this negotiating process at the end of summer, early fall. And the board at that point in time were going to vote on this particular water use permit. And instead got a curveball from one of the board members, longtime board member, and he proclaimed that Seven Springs Water Company is the permit applicant, and he wanted to see Nestle on the permit application too as a co-applicant. And so that curveball sent everybody into a tizzy, and the attorneys for Nestle and Seven Springs objected greatly and did not see the point of that technically, legally. And only Seven Springs needed to be the applicant. And so as a result of that maneuver, in a sense, to make sure that Nestle was the one, when the water levels go low, or when there's a drought, or when there's a problem going on, that they could, in fact, have the permit being enforced through Nestle's oversight instead of just Seven Springs Water Company. So that went back in front of the administrative hearing process because that was not part of the negotiatings. And then the court case proceeded as most administrative court cases do, in front of a judge with the hearing process, with the testimonies from both sides, with their experts. Well, prior to that, when the board member said what he said, our Santa Fe River tried to have our own administrative hearing, because then we recognized that after the board member said what he said, that we might have we really thought that we had an in to have our own administrative hearing, because at this point in time, they were going to vote on this permit in one way or another. Well, when we tried to get into the lawsuits, a lawsuit of our own, on our own merits of science, of public interest, of reasonable and beneficial use of the spring water, the water in the state of Florida, the water that feeds the Santa Fe River, we got boxed in through procedural matters associated with the court case, and we ended up in that process. The judge put us, our case, into the Nestle case, or the Seven Springs case, instead of having our own separate case. And so because he did that, because the courts did that, we were not allowed to bring our arguments into this case because they were very separate than what the arguments were already being argued. And so we tried every which way to bring in arguments of our own into that process, and repeatedly were not allowed. And so in the end, we then decided that our best bet to just understand what was going on internally in the legal process was to of this case was to file as an intervener. And we filed as intervener. But again, that was still a boxed-in situation where we had no place to bring in any of our arguments, any of our concerns, any which way. We were so boxed in, it was pathetic at best. So we had to unfortunately get out of that case altogether and pull out. And our attorneys, we pulled out of the case. And so then the judge ruled after all the testimony, like I was saying, and ruled favorably with the arguments that the Nestle attorneys presented. And the water managers tried to argue ownership and legal control, which was a big part of the original points anyway, but the judge wouldn't have any part of it because a lot of the legal control associated with the arguments that the water management district set up, because of time constraints, the judge said basically that those things should have been decided a long time ago. This is not the time or the place to be deciding those things. And this water use won't have any harm, according to the science that the water managers and the Seven Springs Water Company brought forward. Their science, they never vetted our science, but that's how it went, unfortunately. And that it wouldn't have any harm on the water resources. And it was a reasonable and beneficial use, and really, really glossed over the public interest element. And the point to that public interest element, especially for your listener audience, is that the water management portal, the permit portal for this particular one permit, this is one water use permit for putting our spring water, our fresh water, into plastic bottles, making roughly almost 6,000 filled plastic single-use, throwaway, disposable bottles per minute. It's hard to really wrap your heads around those numbers per minute when they're operating. And I got a lot of pushback from the employees that work there saying, oh, that's ridiculous. Well, they're basing their ridiculous ideas, because a lot of them have worked there in the past, on that old water use, which was under 300,000 gallons of water. This one is four times basically the amount of water that has ever been pulled there, which also leads us to have a lot of concerns about the water resource at Ginny Springs, at Devil's Eye, at Rum Island, at Blue Springs, at Sawdust Springs, at July Springs, at all of the little springs, Deer, at all the little tiny springs, Jonathan, that are in this vicinity within a mile of the extraction point.
We're speaking with Marilee Mulwitz-Gibson. She's a board member with the group Our Santa Fe River, and this is WMNF's Midpoint. Just a few weeks ago, the judge ruled, the administrative law judge. Now what happens next? Does this have to go back to the board of the Suwannee River Water Management District? And their staff had already recommended denying this permit, but what's the next step?
So the next step, of course, we don't know what the staff will recommend at this moment. It's a legal uphill battle financially, and the Nestle attorneys are very skilled attorneys with Florida law, and the board will most likely, according to the staff members, they are trying to arrange a Suwannee River Water Management District board meeting. I don't think they're still at full capacity, but I think they have 7 or 8 members on that board presently. They just put a few more board members on the seated board because we've only had 5 at one point in time, and there should be 9. So there's some new people on the board that are unfamiliar with the minutia of this particular issue. I mean, mind you, our Santa Fe River and lots of the public have been approaching the podium, writing letters, submitting comments, emails, phone calls. And so here we are in the final stretch, and there's a few new board members that really don't know as much as a few of the other old, longer-term board members. So the board at the Water Management District that is an appointed board by Governor DeSantis and confirmed by the Senate, that board will be the ultimate decider of this particular water use permit's fate. And that meeting, the staff is considering, they haven't decided the date yet, but they're considering a special meeting, quote-unquote, special meeting at the end of February to accommodate supposedly, I mean, here's the dog and pony show that's going to prevail here, folks. It's like, so they're going to maybe make a special meeting instead of a monthly board meeting where most of the time these water use permits are being decided. And with COVID, they want a big meeting room so people can social distance. And then they're going to invite the public. And of course, we're going to elevate that as an organization and invite the public to speak and, you know, tell their side of the story and all this, you know, whatever. But the reality is, if a judge from the state of Florida, from an administrative court rule, said, yeah, I'm okay with this, the chances of the board voting against the judge are not lost on us, right? So we're hunkering down our Santa Fe River. We're preparing for a legal challenge. The judge during the court case even had made comments and references to this will probably be an appealed situation, and it might most likely will go through an appellate court because we will, depending on the vote, and if it goes the way we don't want it to, we will most likely appeal it through an administrative hearing process again, and through that process we'll probably get shut out in one way or another, so we'll go through an appellate. But the point is, the board has the ultimate authority to vote on this permit, and it may not be held on the second Tuesday of a month when most board meetings are held. In a sense, it's near disenfranchisement to put it on a special meeting day at a special time in a special time of the month in a special place in a special building, special stuff, instead of during the due process of when these things get vetted. The other thing is recognizing COVID. It doesn't sound like listen, we had 19,000 comments. The vast majority, probably 90% of them, were in opposition. We read 2,000 of the comments with a team of people. We couldn't get through all 19. The bottom line is the district hasn't even read all the comments yet. They haven't even categorized these comments. The public is incensed with this permit, more so than almost any other environmental impact in the state of Florida, more so than almost even the toll road, although the toll road's really bad, everybody. Hope everybody gets involved with that one, too. But 19,000 comments in a government portal is no small feat. And they didn't, the attorneys did not once mention that to the judge.
Well, as we wrap up, Marilee Mulwitz-Gibson with Our Santa Fe River, why don't you give people an idea of what's at stake here? If the permit does go through, and if indeed Seven Springs Water and Nestle withdraw nearly 1 million gallons of water a day, putting it in plastic bottles, how would that affect all the water systems you spoke about earlier, the Santa Fe River and all of those associated springs?
extracting that amount of water on a continuous basis all day long will create some sort of conal situation, a cone of depression of sorts, where water will eventually migrate to that extraction point, and then the things that are surrounding that water are going to naturally fill up with some other water that's flowing underneath our groundwater resources down to the next, you know, down through our system. Chances are it's going to impact the springs that I just mentioned, the springs that are associated in that vicinity. Those are already delicate springs already. They don't have the discharge that they had even 20 years ago when this permit first got online. Everything's changing. All of us are using more water to pull it out of an extractive point directly out of the springs that are associated with the most iconic experiences in the state of Florida is a travesty beyond words, because you're only before 300,000, now we're talking almost a million. It's going to have an impact. People downstream from this water grab already for the past 20 years have already talked about their impacts. Neighbors and riparian owners and people that use the water also. And so we'll see an impact one way or the other. The other impact, of course, will be more plastic on the planet. How much does the planet need for throwaway plastic bottles? And our big push right now is to write a postcard. We want to flood the Water Management District with postcards. Since they didn't get the electronic correspondence of the 19,000 comments, we want to make sure that they're getting postcards all day long. So if any of your listeners grab a postcard, grab a stamp, and put it in the mail, and the address is Suwannee River Water Management District Board Members, 9225 County Road 49, Live Oak, Florida, 32060. We want to see them, their staff, their people that work there, to see at least 100 postcards coming in every day until this permit gets vetted, either in a special meeting or at the Tuesday board meeting or whenever. That's one thing people can do to help us elevate this issue. The other thing is, for Pete's sakes, filter your water at home if you don't like it and get off the bottle water kit. And I mean it. I mean, it's like, why are we buying our water on grocery store shelves when we could be filtering our water from home, saving money? And then in the meantime, once that gets into effect more, where we're not buying our water off the grocery shelves, then you work with your municipalities, you work with your cities, you work with your counties, you work with your utilities, and you get your infrastructure fixed so that you're getting healthy and clean water delivered to your tap. You're paying for it. You're paying for it through your faucet, through your monthly bills. You need to make them accountable that your water should be clean enough where it supports your healthy life. Because taking it out of the springs like this, taking it out of the environment the way that we're doing this right now, and I mean we, because we're all buying this stuff, we need to stop that. We need to stop the plastic water. We need to stop buying that stuff because it destroys the planet on a global scale. 6,000 bottles a minute.
Marilee, thanks so much for coming on WMNF's Midpoint today.
Thanks for having me again, Sean. Everybody have a great day. Stop buying bottled water, put it in your reusable water, and save the planet.
Well, that's Marilee Malwitz-Gibson, a board member with the group Our Santa Fe River, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. Let me read a couple of texts that came in while that was playing. Couldn't the water companies just use filtered water? And isn't it just for marketing purposes to claim that you're selling spring water? That's a text that came in from area code 813. Clark is saying, can you please repeat the address? I'll repeat the address right now. She's saying the Suwannee River Water Management District Board Members. And the number of the address is 9225 County Road 49, Live Oak, Florida. 32060 is the address that she gave out late in that interview. Also, David writes, Hi, Sean. I find it really interesting how Nestle's Zephyr Hills bottles have a greenwashing campaign with the "This Is Not Trash" slogan posted on the labels recently. It feels a bit disingenuous to me, and yet another way for Nestle to justify pulling even more water for bottling. So thank you for writing that, David. Also, we had a comment from Lou in Plant City about our earlier segment. It says, "Hi, Sean and guests. The time limits for state benefits is 12 weeks. How are people counted as being unemployed after that expires? I think that they are. I think that they're still counted as unemployed, but they're just not getting unemployment benefits anymore." And Lou continues, "Do your guests have any idea how many people that were working for cash are being counted among the unemployed? You know, that's a hard one. If they probably aren't officially unemployed because they weren't listed as officially employed before, if they were just working for cash. So thanks for those questions, Lou. And I want to thank everyone who, Timothy is writing about the address again. I'll write back to him directly. Email me, dj@wmnf.org, if you need the address. But I want to thank Frank Knox. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. Our two-day membership drive last week came up about $5,000 short, so if you'd like the information and the music that we bring you, please help support the station at wmnf.org. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg.